Hey yo, and here we go. Welcome to another episode of We Talk Music. I am your host, Mr. Brett Podcast, and I have an extra special guest with me today. He is currently the bassist for Last in Line, and of course, you know, there's some Big Noise, and you got the Raiding the Rock Vault, and I mean, even before that, Billy Idol and Ozzy Osbourne. You know, I think it would actually be easier to list the people that you haven't played with, but ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to introduce Phil Soussan. How are you, Phil?
I'm very well, thanks, Brett, and thank you so much for having me on the show. And, yeah, that's very funny. I guess you kind of work your way around a musical community, you know, like sort of stepping stones, one project to the next project, each one hopefully taking you closer to musical nirvana than the last one.
Well, the reason that we're here today is to talk about the new Last in Line album, 2. And I got to say, it's a really, really good album. I think it's even better than the first one. And in this case, so what would you say is the most interesting thing about Last in Line 2?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for saying that. Take that very much as a compliment, but secondly, without trying to sound too bloated or anything, I agree with you. I think it's a great record, and the reason I say that is because any time that I've done records before, by the time you finish with it, you've probably heard it 125 times, and you really don't want to hear it for a while. And this record is very strange. I put it on in my car. I have it on my headphones sometimes, and I find myself going back and listening to it, and finding things in it that are really cool. That doesn't happen too often, and so for that reason, I think, you know, we may be sitting on a really good album. You know, we lose perspective. I mean, honestly, after this amount of time, it's, you can't see the forest for the trees. So. Yeah, I say it quite naively. I mean, I don't, you know, very often I'll say to people, hey, what do you think? You know, because I'm not sure anymore. But the fact that I keep going back and listening to things on the record and finding things that I really enjoy tells me we have a great record. And that in itself is, I think, what's really fantastic about the chemistry that's evolved in this band. And in fact, that's exactly what's happened. It's sort of evolved. I mean, I came in, I don't want to jump ahead of your questions or anything, but as you know, I came in initially as to replace Jimmy, Jimmy Bain, who had passed away. And so I don't think the band knew what they were going to do at the time. But to listen to this record now, I mean, it really represents something quite special.
So would everybody else say that you're a good fit then for the band?
Like to say so. I mean, I think you probably have to ask them. I mean, I can certainly, I can tell you what it's like. You know, at the beginning, I think it was they really weren't sure what the plans for the band would be. I think initially it was just to go out and do some shows and take this material that they had worked so hard on with Jimmy Bain, and at least take his effort to the people, because he was never able to do that. And in a way, that was his final legacy. So I think they felt it was their duty to do this, if it was going to be at all possible. I came in as a fairly obvious choice. I mean, I've known Vivian for a long, long time, although I've never had the pleasure of working with him before. And I have worked with Andrew Freeman. Obviously, we've done a lot of Rock Vault stuff together. And Vinny, I've been working and playing with him since back in a long while back. So there was that connection. I was also very good friends with Jimmy Bain. And, you know, when I first moved to Los Angeles, I actually we lived together. So that's how close friends we were. And, you know, I have to tell you, there was between Ozzy and Dio, who were very much sister bands, I like to call them. I mean, I'm not going to get into a debate on who was better or worse or superior, whatever, but they definitely were related bands. And whatever happened between Ozzy and Ronnie James Dio, or if indeed there was anything, there was always a great deal of admiration for the people who played in those bands, and we felt a great peer closeness. So our counterparts were always very much respected, whether it was Randy Castillo and Vinny Appice, whether it was myself with Jimmy Bain, or whether it was the guitar players, you know, whether it was Vivian and Jake, or Vivian and I guess Zach, although Zach came far, far later. Because of that connection, there was an automatic good fit. And I think that I believe they wanted to play with a few people. You know, when something like this happens, there's always a few suggestions. But it was, from what I understand, it was a very, it was a kind of a, I don't want to say slam dunk, but it was something that was just felt right.
Well, there's no question that both Ozzy and Ronnie James Dio had an amazing sense of picking musicians that were just, you know, top notch.
Yeah, the story is, though, that I guess it was Jimmy who called Vivian and called him up about the gig. He'd known about him, and I don't want to step on his story because I wouldn't want to say anything that was inaccurate, but from what I understand, there was a connection through Brian Robertson that maybe Robbo knew of Vivian and he'd seen him play or something, and then, you know, Brian Robertson and Jimmy Bain were in a band called Wild Horses together. In fact, that's the way I met Jimmy.
Because
I was very good friends with Brian Robertson growing up. Brian Robertson was very tight with Phil Lynott, and I was good friends with Phil Lynott. And so, you know, then I met Jimmy Bain in England way, way back. And later on in years, we ended up becoming really good friends. That's one of the cool things that happens in this business is these friendships that come, you know, come and go, and it's almost like a sort of family thing, you know? To answer your question, I think, and Ozzy has definitely spent a lot of time seeking out good guitar players. I know from personal experience that when we had to find a guitar player after Jake left the band, Randy Castillo and I were holed up in an apartment here in Los Angeles for some 4 months. And we went through 400 names of guitar players to find the right guitar player.
Wow.
It's not to say we played with 400 people. We had a filtering system and we managed to narrow it down. But that was a gargantuan feat. And by the end, I remember we were looking at each other saying, Jesus, we've run out of all the people who play guitar in the world. We can do that. You know, I mean, replacing Jake was a very, very difficult thing. Jake was a great guitar player and he was, you know, he was fantastic, and we just couldn't see how the band was going to go on, you know. But at the end, you know, Zach was the right guy. Obviously, looking at him today, he's proved that he's a tremendous force. As has Vivian. I mean, Vivian, you know, as far as I'm concerned, those first three Dio albums, or maybe even the first two Dio albums, the ones which I keep going back to. What happened afterwards was not as impactful to me, but then, you know, to see what Vivian did after that, going on to Whitesnake and eventually to Def Leppard, I mean, you can see just the great musician that he's evolved into, you know, and his journey has been fantastic.
Yeah, it's very true. It's a definite interesting journey for him. One of the questions that I wanted to ask is about the bass tone in this case. Like, the bass is really up front, I find, in this album, which I definitely appreciate. Was that kind of like you, or was that a little more Jeff?
No, that's definitely me. It was, you know, the whole idea of this band is that it represents a three-piece band. When I say three-piece, I mean three-piece and a vocalist, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the purest form of rock and roll. I absolutely love that format. Every band that I've ever loved had that format, whether it was Led Zeppelin or whether it was The Who or whether it was, the Spiders from Mars. I mean, it's just a great format, and it's a great British format as well. And I think it just lends itself to a certain attitude. when playing in a three-piece band like that, you can't really mess around too much. You have to be on top of your game, and you have to make sure that you are playing 110% the whole of the time. If a guitar player goes to do a solo, you have to be covering underneath it. Same thing with Ozzy. I mean, we were a three-piece band effectively with Ozzy as well. And because this album is not completely saturated with overdubs and other enhancements or other arrangements, sorry, that's a better word, other arrangements, the bass has to be up front. I mean, it's got to be definite. Led Zeppelin, another great example. I mean, when you listen to Led Zeppelin, you hear how the bass has to carry certain things. I mean, it has to join what's going on, and it has to tie everything in with the vocals. All of that notwithstanding, Vinny's not exactly a light drummer. I mean, he's probably... I've been very blessed and privileged to have played with probably some of the best drummers in the world in my career. And I've been a little bit spoiled on drummers. But Vinny has to be, without a doubt, the loudest and most probably aggressive drummer that I've played with. And if you are anything less than that, it's just not going to work. So when we went in, you know, we did actually sit there and try recording. I got some bass sounds, and Jeff said, hey, you know, this is a pretty good bass sound. Let's work with this. And I remember I took it out and I said, yeah, I'm not really happy with this, and I brought it back to my studio, and then I started messing around with amps and with different things and getting the exact tone, and I cut a track and sent it back to Jeff and for his opinion, and he said, great, let's have everyone have a listen to it. We listened to it and we said, oh, this is way better. This has a really great personality, and so we ended up finishing the album with that tone, and so that's how that came about. You know, this album was very much a band production. Jeff was definitely there at the beginning. We recorded with him, but I think the time, but the hardest thing with Jeff was tying down his time, and he's very busy, and I don't think there was a sufficient allocation of time to how long this album was going to take. Not just in studio time, but the fact that everybody has other agendas, it was very difficult to find the time for everybody to be in the room at the same time. And because of that, you know, that necessity being the mother of invention, and the fact that I produce as well, Andrew has a studio, and you know, Chris Collier, who makes the record, has a studio. We were able to do this in a very 2019 method by actually doing a record in multiple locations. So it was really interesting, and people who are interested in the recording process have been asking us questions about that. You know, what was it like, and how was that? But, you know, Jeff, of course, has a fantastic personality as a producer. We started that. We recorded most of the basic tracks with him, and then we pretty much continued on the production under different locations and what have you. That's how it all came together. But I appreciate you making comments about the bass sound. It's nice to hear things like that, because so often in so many types of music, it's almost like it's something that's there, but it's just not very well defined. And I think it's a big part of the music that we wrote.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I just, it's one of those things. Like, I always try to listen for each of the individual instruments. I mean, the guitar, of course, is usually easy, but it's finding the bass and really like seeing how somebody's playing the instrument that interests me always.
We like to put subtleties into that, and when people pick up on that and they are able to hear that, then it makes it all worthwhile. So that's just terrific to hear.
I'm interested now, because people talk about being in the pocket with the drummer, like the bass and the drummer being the back end. What does that mean to you?
I suppose I got one of life's lessons very, very early on. When I was very much younger, I played for a while in a band with Simon Kirk from Free and from Bad Company. Free, there's another band. You see, Free is a band that I grew up on as well, and there was so much creativity between bass and drums and guitar in that band. And, you know, we had Paul Kossoff playing guitar around Andy Fraser. And Andy Fraser was one of the most creative bass players ever. But Simon Kirk as well played very sparse. So when I played with Simon, he looked at me, stopped me the first day and said, hey, you know, what's this off to the races stuff? I mean, hey, you're not going to get a prize for finishing first. You need to know where you're putting your bass notes. And if you're not hearing the click of a kick drum before that note comes out, then you're not playing in the right place. And so at a young age, I learned how to play position of the actual bass notes with relation to the drums where it should be. Sometimes it should be just behind the drums, and sometimes it should be a little bit more on top of the drums, but never ahead of the drums. And it depends what you're trying to do. And it's a skill that's taken a long, long time to learn. But I think when you hear a track that's locked in with the drums that way, a strange thing happens. And that is that a riff that might sound like it has high energy all of a sudden becomes very powerful. And you can, if there are any musicians out there, you can try this with your bass and your drummer. See if you can play something like way up on top with the bass and drums, like a groove. And not something fast, just something slow. And then pull it back and see what happens. All of a sudden, this heaviness enters the room, and it's working. You know, it's a great exercise.
Wow, that's awesome. Really fascinating, no question. So one of the things now that I love is the fact that, I mean, in all the people that you've played with, you played on one of my favorite albums back in the early, very early 90s, Beggars and Thieves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was too bad. That was a great record, and it sort of came at the wrong time. You know, I think a lot of records, you know, at the end of the 80s, we're starting to scratch our heads and going, this is kind of corny. And this was a pretty good band, you know, and it was a good record, and it was just at the beginning of the grunge thing. And it was very bittersweet, to be honest. I mean, there was a lot I liked about grunge. I have a background that included a, you know, early British punk to some extent, because I grew up in that, you know? I mean, that was the music that was going on when I was in my teens.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in, you know, I grew up in Maida Vale in London, where bands like, you know, Kilburn and the High Roads and Chelsea started, that became The Clash, and that became, you know, Ian Dury, and became Generation X. And so, you know, there was, of course, something I related to in grunge music, but I had a love-hate relationship with it, because it was destroying the world that I'd kind of established myself in. And Beggars and Thieves was one of the casualty albums, I think, that was a good record, wrong timing, you know?
Yeah, for sure. You know, so many around there. But I mean, that one always stuck out, because I think it's so easy to see it and to kind of write it off. But the second that you really give it more listens, it actually has a lot more to offer than a lot of them do.
Yeah, I think it does, and I think there were some good songs on there. There was some good writing on there. We worked on it with Steve Thompson, Michael Barbiero, who were terrific producers at the time, producer engineers, and it was a fun time. It was a fun time doing that record, you know, compared to the grunge stuff that was coming out, it was overproduced. You know, obviously that the beauty of what happened in grunge was its simplistic nature, and it sort of came back down to basics again. So that probably made it sound a little bit dated. But it's definitely a record that whenever I go back and listen to it, I enjoy it very much. But it did okay, you know. I mean, the album did reasonably well. We were also getting... we were starting to do some touring as well, but we were also starting to get into that beginnings of the whole, you know, the CD copying and that stuff as well. So there were two or three headwinds at that time. The early 90s was a challenging time, I think, not just for rock bands or, you know, 80s rock bands, but for music in general.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So one of the things that you do a lot of is songwriting. So tell me about your songwriting style.
Well, you know, songwriting isn't something you can kind of force, and that's the hardest thing about it. You know, you can, I think it was Paul Simon that said that he cannot write a song at 10 o'clock every morning, but what he can do is arrange to be seated at a notepad at 10 o'clock every morning so that if inspiration strikes, he'll be ready to write something. But it's very difficult. You have to have that inspiration. And sometimes the inspiration can come because you're around the right people. So it takes me a long, long time to write on my own. I have to have that idea that just makes me very excited. And if it doesn't do that, I tend to lose interest, or I tend to put it away for another, for a rainy day, you know? Normally I would write, I think I start writing music and a melody line first. And I can write on the bass, or I can write on the acoustic guitar. But I'll find something where there's a little piece of music and there's a melody line that goes with it that sounds unique. And once I've got that, then I can start building on it. Sometimes it all happens in one go. It happens very fast, and those are the moments that we all strive for. But very often it comes from the inspiration of being with the right person as well. I wrote a lot of tremendous songs with Steve Lukather. And Steve and I, when we worked together, he was always in a rush, never really had any time. It was like, we've got a writing session, he'd show up and say, oh, I've got to be gone in 15 minutes or 20 minutes. And I'd say, okay, well, what are we going to do? Let's pick something up. And somehow or other, because of the fact that we only had 15 or 20 minutes, we'd come up with something. And then I had the time to do a lot of work on it afterwards and to take it forward. Quite different from the way that the writing process worked with Last in Line, but we could talk about that in if you like as well. But that's generally my writing process. That's pretty much what I do.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about the Last in Line writing process.
Yeah. So it was odd. I wasn't sure what was going to happen with this band. As I said before, we initially were just out there just doing these shows, and that was probably as far as it was going to go. But a chemistry evolved in the band. I think it the band started to gel, and I think that I started to integrate with the band as much as they started integrating with me, and we started to find our own relationships and our own humor and the tightness that we got. And being on stage, looking over and seeing Viv, you know, really with a big, huge, beaming grin on his face, sort of gave me some indication that there was something that was taking place here that he was enjoying as much as I was enjoying and as much as the other guys were enjoying. So when it came down to doing a second record, that was a given. We said, well, we're going to do a record. But it was a little stressful. You know, they'd never gone in a studio with me, and I'd never gone in with them. And, you know, there's a little anxiety because you say, well, I hope this is going to work out, you know. And what happens if it doesn't work out? You never know. So I said to Viv, I pulled him aside and said, look, when I write, I tend to put all these ideas onto a little portable recorder. And I've got, you know, I don't know, 60, 80 bits and pieces on here. Should I start to organize some of this stuff so that I can, maybe we'll have something to you know, that I can bring to the table? And he said, no, he said, we're not going to do that. He said, my whole idea with this band is to preserve what we did in the early Dio days. And we had a way of working, and that is the chemistry that we had, and I want to keep that chemistry. So I said, well, pray tell, what is that? And he said, well, what we'll do is we just don't bring anything in. We'll just go in, we'll literally plug our instruments in, and we'll start jamming, and we'll just construct stuff as it happens. I said, okay, well, let's try that. I mean, that sounds like a great idea. And the first day we got together, we went in, and I think that first day, Viv turned up a bit late. Vinny and I showed up earlier, and we started banging around on a riff drum thing, and I had this idea of something coming out of it. And then Viv walked in and said, oh, that sounds like an idea. Let's work on that. And that actually became Electrified. after that happened, there was a great big sigh of relief, at least on my part, because I knew that there was going to be some chemistry. And we started coming up with stuff very, very quickly, as a testament to the chemistry that was in the room. Not only that, but that really is the ideal way of working. I mean, for anyone who's listening who's in a band, I find the idea of writing a song on your own is very one-dimensional. You find yourself going through the same thoughts, the same chord changes, the same melodies, the same cliches, the same everything. And it's really when you interact with someone else that you get that creativity, and you come up with something that is very unique. And because of that, it's a very organic way of working, and I think it represents the band better than anything possibly could. This album has been written, every part has been written as a unit. It's every part of it is a little piece of each of us, and that makes it magical to me.
Wow, that's really cool. All right, well, I'm running out of time here, which, because I know that I have about 8 billion questions that I could ask you, so let's talk quickly about the tour. You're starting out on tour in a couple of days, February 7th?
Yeah, we've actually already put 6 shows behind us as well, and they've been fantastic. Really fun. I mean, it's we've been out there playing material from the 2 LIL albums, and obviously we have some songs that Vivian and Vinny wrote back in the day with Ronnie that people want to hear, and so we include those songs. Viv and Vinny are quite adamant that to tell the story that when they started Dio, they only had 9 songs on that record, so they were actually playing a lot of Black Sabbath stuff at the time on those first tours to fill out the set. And they both feel that this is a very similar situation. But I'm glad to say that people really are responding, and they want to hear the new material. And that is an incredible blessing, because I don't need to tell you, a lot of bands playing classic rock-styled music find themselves playing the heritage tracks, the tracks that people want to hear. And then when they play new stuff, everyone gets up and goes to the bathroom, you know? And it's been kind of opposite with us. People are actually calling out for the new songs. They like them, and we're very honored for that. I don't think we take it very lightly at all. It's a real privilege. So that we have the fans to thank for that.
Well, there's no question that you've got a great library of tracks, and the new album being so strong certainly helps. Well, this is the point where I give you the chance to plug everything, tell people where to get the album. It comes out February 22nd, so tell the folks where to find it.
Well, go to lastinlineofficial.com, and you can find all the links there to the record. Please pre-order it. We've got some amazing merchandise and amazing products, one-off products on the pre-order site. You can also go to my website, which is philsoussan.com, and through there you can find your way around. Lots of material there. Of course, the usual stuff. We've got the Instagram, which is Last in Line Official, and we have Facebook, of course, which is Last in Line. You can find us there. But, we're not hard to find. I mean, if I did anything wrong, I'm sure they wouldn't have a hard time trying to arrest us. So, please... Or at least give a listen to the 2 singles that are out, the videos that are out, which are Landslide, which is the first one, and Year of the Gun, which is our lyric video that we just put out. And we've got a 3rd coming out, which is called Blackout the Sun. That's supposed to come out this week. And if you like those, please, please buy the record. If this means anything to you, there are tracks on that record I love, that I really, really like even more than the singles that are out there. It really is a good record.
For sure, for sure. There's no doubt about it. If I had time, I'd list them all. But Phil Soussan, thank you so much for coming on the show. We totally appreciate it. And a great individual, but you're a great bass player and all that stuff. So please buy the album.
Thank you, Brett. Thank you so much. And all the best to you guys at We Talk Music and to your audience as well. We hope to see you soon out there on the road.
All right. Well, hopefully you get to come to Canada. So that would be awesome.
look forward to it tremendously. Got a lot of friends in Canada. We'd love to come up there. So that's something we're looking forward to.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Phil. Have a good day.
Terrific. Thank you, too.
All right. Bye now.